Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the appointed hour. We do not have a quorum, but we're going to start the meeting because I start my meeting on time. If my staff would please get around the table, we'd be better off. We cannot do anything official yet, but I'd like to warn Representative Johnson that there will be a correction to the minutes today, so your job has already expanded.
Figure that out?
See if you can, you look over the minutes, see if you can figure out what's wrong.
Okay.
If you can't, we'll let you know.
Your chair did change with the size.
Did you get a bad chair?
Yeah.
What happened? We will call the meeting to order as soon as we get a quorum. Today's agenda is pretty simple, but also very interesting. We start today with the Department of Public Safety, and you're welcome to come forward. I don't know who's going to be on the hot seat today, but the commissioner will be on the hot seat. That's quite all right. I'm sorry to rush people, but I hate to let my committee get in the habit of expecting me to start late. It's just a bad precedent, and while it may seem a little rushed, that's better in my mind. So please introduce yourselves for the record and go ahead with your presentation as soon as you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mona Doman, and I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety, and to my right is Deputy Commissioner Cassandra O'Hearn in our agency, and you'll hear from her as we take a little bit deeper dive into the overview of our agency. But I'd like to just start out by saying thank you very much for taking the time and inviting us to give an overview of our agency. We appreciate being here with you. In addition to the Deputy Commissioner, we also have staff and division directors of the divisions that are under the jurisdiction of this committee, and I'll introduce them in a little bit. The Department of Public Safety is a state agency with local impact across the entire state. When an incident happens anywhere in the state of Minnesota, local jurisdictions that don't have the necessary resources to respond reach out to the state, and we are there to assist them when we can. And we do that in many different ways. Yep. Additionally, under your jurisdiction is the Minnesota State Patrol. On a daily basis, they work with public safety partners across the state to reduce traffic crashes and fatalities on our roads and highways. That's one of the primary functions of what they do. Yesterday, you may have seen on the news about the explosion in Dodge Center in Dodge County. Three of our agencies were assisting down there yesterday. Our State Patrol was there to assist. Our State Fire Marshal's Office was there to help investigate, and the Office of Pipeline Safety responded as well as they learned more about what happened in the incident. And I could give you daily examples of how we work to help keep people safe across the state of Minnesota, which is the mission of our agency. We fulfill our mission through prevention, education, preparation, recovery, and enforcement. And our focus is the same as all of our local public safety partners that we interact with across the state, and that is saving lives, providing efficient, effective, and professional service. And we work every day to maintain the public's trust and build upon the strong partnerships that have been developed over the years. The Department of Public Safety consists of 10 separate divisions, and as you can see on the slide, on the lower left you'll see administrative and related services. That division actually has three functions within it: human resources, affirmative action and internal affairs, and then our fiscal division. The slide shows, actually, if you look at it, the complexity and the diversity that our agency deals with on a daily basis. And we'll talk about the divisions that fall under the jurisdiction of this committee in a minute, and they are all located on the left side of the screen. But I want to introduce the division directors that lead those agencies. And so the first on the screen is the Minnesota State Patrol, and the State Patrol is led by Colonel Matt Langer, and he's in the room. The second is the Office of Traffic Safety, led by Donna Berger, the director. A Driver and Vehicle Services, who some of you know, Don Olson, leads that division. The Office of Pipeline Safety is actually led by our State Fire Marshal, Bruce West. And then our Human Resources Division, I'm not sure if Lowell was able to be here. Lowell Thompson. Our Fiscal Division is Larry Freund, and our Affirmative Action and Internal Affairs Director is Lynn Mueller. So this slide shows a chronological kind of history of the Department of Public Safety. I know it's small print, and I won't read every single one of the entries, but in 1905, the Division of the State Fire Marshal was created, and then you'll see in 1969, actually, the Department of Public Safety was created. And we just thought we'd throw this in, a picture of in 1969, when the Department of Public Safety was created. That's the squad cars that our state troopers were driving at the time. So we've evolved quite a bit since that time. We thought that was a good picture from the archives. Yes, Gary.
Commissioner, as long as you've paused for a moment, I'm going to take this opportunity to officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Meeting's called to order. Representative Johnson, do you have a motion for us?
Well, I do have a motion to move to amend the minutes, and the only thing I can assume the amendment would be would it. I assume you call the order the meeting to order at 1 o'clock instead of 1:01. Did I get that right?
You failed the test.
Oh.
You're close. You just go up and a little bit further to the right. You might note that it says first meeting, and it really wasn't our first meeting.
Okay. So I would like to amend the minutes to read that this was not to remove second meeting from the top, or?
Well, you move first. It's
mine says second.
Well, you go down from there.
Okay, yeah, make that the second meeting there in the first paragraph?
Good. Yes.
That's my amendment, yes. And that's my motion.
Ding, ding, ding. Good job. Representative Johnson moves to approve the minutes as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign, the minutes of our second meeting are approved. Commissioner, I did call it for order. Commissioner, please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the next slide shows a pie chart of our base budget. Our base budget is almost $731 million, and we receive funding from something like 500 different sources. Primarily, though, they are broken down between the Trunk Highway Fund, the General Fund, State Government Special Revenue, Highway User Tax Distribution Funds, and other miscellaneous special revenue funds. Our expenses, totaling the same, $731 million, include total compensation, which is salary and benefits for staff funded by appropriated funds, operating costs such as rent, fuel costs and supplies, and then local assistance and transfers. So before I turn it over to Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn for a bit deeper dive into the divisions, I'd just like to again thank you for your time today, and we look forward to working with you through this session and beyond, and we appreciate your support, and we'll be available at any time for any questions that you may have of our agency. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. We're going to talk a little bit about each of the divisions that are funded under the transportation. We start with our administrative and related services. As the commissioner mentioned, the Department of Public Safety is a complex agency. You saw 10 very different divisions that do very different work. Of course, it takes administrative support in the areas of the commissioner's office, human resources, fiscal and administrative services, technology, support, and communications in order to ensure that our critical work can get done. The Minnesota State Patrol is probably one of our most visible divisions. Certainly the troopers are identifiable. Their mission, right, to protect and serve all people in the state, to provide excellent service across the state with its primary focus on enforcement, education, and providing assistance to allied agencies in all areas of traffic safety. As you can see by this slide, and again, it's a little bigger over there. Yep, right there. The areas, are we on the same? Yep, we're on the same.
Oh, Mr. Chair? Oh, I can just look at, never mind, excuse me, go ahead. I'll look at my, never mind.
Did
I
you
don't
have
need anything. I got it taken care of.
You're taken care of?
Yes.
Sorry about the confusion.
Yes. That's all right. We're here to answer any questions, Mr. Chair and Representative. The State Patrol provides a wide array of services beyond the troopers that we're so familiar with. But speaking of troopers, they patrolled over 18 million miles of highway in 2016, made over 392,000 traffic stops, and assisted the public 86,000 times. They also provided over 1,100 safety education presentations to schools, to community members and organizations, and things like that. The State Patrol includes 885 full-time sworn and unsworn personnel. They receive an annual appropriation of $87.9 million from a variety of sources, from the Trunk Highway Fund, from the HUDT Fund, General Fund, as well as federal funds. I should note that there are 49 trooper cadets that will start at the Trooper Academy this Sunday. The Office of Traffic Safety, its primary focus is to promote safe driving through education and awareness with a goal to reduce traffic deaths and serious injury on Minnesota roadways. They do a lot of public outreach and communication. You are likely very familiar with many of their messages around distracted driving, around wearing a seatbelt, reducing speed, reducing drinking and driving, and placing children in proper car seats.
Deputy Commissioner, we do have a question from Representative Kosnick.
I think you answered it, but there was 44 recent troopers that graduated from your patrol kit?
No, 49 are starting in the academy on Sunday. There are a total of, Chief would know this off the top of his head, 587 troopers currently, but 49 have made it through the current hiring process and will start their Trooper Academy, the training, starting on Sunday.
Okay.
So they'll be sworn in approximately May. Sorry about that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kosnick.
How frequently do you hold the Trooper Academy, please?
Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, once a year.
Okay, thank you.
A question from Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask our Deputy Commissioner here, I'm back at the mission one, that's what I was,
okay.
You went through it really fast last time, and I wanted to see it, and I didn't realize I have them in my folder here. But what I wanted to ask about, you do policy development and support. So is that you coming to testify at the legislature, or do you actually become advisors to us on what kind of policies that we could do to help reduce deaths and serious injuries? Or sometimes we propose policies that actually are going to more than likely contribute to more deaths and serious injuries. What kind of role do you play with us in the legislature when it talks about your mission through policy development?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, our role at the department is to be continually on looking at trends and new practices and, you know, everything in between. And our role here at the legislature is to, we on a daily basis, especially during session, we monitor bills that are being introduced every day. We have people doing bill reviews and really vetting what the impact to not only our agency but to the people of Minnesota those bills would do, what the impact would be. And certainly we monitor hearings that are going on, and we provide comment and provide certainly advice if you ask, or guidance if you ask for that as well, as far as how it would impact, again, public safety.
Okay. A follow-up, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For example, when we up the speed limits, where Department of Transportation could raise the speed limits to 60 miles per hour on some roadways, did you would you have come to testify what that means for deaths and serious injuries on our roadways, or is that something that we would have to ask you about for you to provide us that information?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, I don't recall specifically if we were here to testify. We would have been aware that that was going on. And I would say, and my hope would be that our division directors, our staff, myself, and the people in my office are monitoring enough so that if we see something that would be a significant public safety risk, we wouldn't wait to be asked. We might reach out to you or to somebody on the committee, maybe the chair, to have that discussion. Not necessarily taking a position before you had policy discussion, but offering statistics and information that we're aware of so you can be best informed to make policy decisions.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Petersburg has a question. And by the way, Commissioner, I hope there's no maybe about it, that you would reach out to the chair.
Did I say maybe? I'm sorry, Mr. Maybe. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one is I think, just a typographical error, but I wanted to clear it back. A couple of slides before, when you talk about the annual appropriation of $87.9 million, the very first line underneath that, I think, has got an extra $100 million in it. Am I correct in that? Because that line says they get $173 million from Trunk Highway Fund, and I think they're only getting $73. Otherwise, the top line appropriation is way low, too. It'd be two or three slides before this.
Right, so.
One more.
There.
Yeah, where you said the annual appropriation of $87.9 million. Obviously, it doesn't include the federal grants, but the other three, the top line is already above that $87.9 million. So, and I know that the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund is about 1% of your budget, 28% is from Trunk Highway. So I'm guessing that's just an extra one in there, correct?
I will need clarification. We'll get that information as to the exact, but it's clearly a typographical error.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe they're just telling you what they want. Representative Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going back to the sworn officers you talked about, you said you have 885 full-time employees. How many of those are sworn officers currently? And you said with the 49 new cadets, is that going to bring you up to your authorized level? I mean, where are you at with your authorized level of sworn officers? Where's that at? And are we being hit with the new cadets? Are that to replace some of the silver tsunami that's going on, retirements and the like?
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, there are currently 587 troopers. My understanding is that there is not a particular number of that they are trying to reach in order to, you know, they want to make sure that they have sufficient staffing to provide the necessary resources all across the state. The current school of 89 cadets that will be starting are certainly also filling behind positions, and that will just continue, which is why there is an academy now every year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Howe has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Good to see you again. Yeah, I'm in the short chair, which doesn't help my stature at all. The question I have is with, you know, the traffic safety research and analysis, have you been looking at what it's going to mean as we continue to work towards or move towards driverless cars, and how what we need to do to start looking at how that's going to affect us?
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, yes, the Department, or Driver and Vehicle Services Division, is looking at the impact of autonomous or self-driving vehicles, as well as the Office of Traffic Safety. I'm sure the Department of Transportation, I can't speak for them, is doing that. But within the department, they are aware of what is happening on the national level, mm-hmm. as well as being ready if this issue comes up in the future through the legislative bodies.
Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for your great work over the years. Particularly, I'm interested in some of your thoughts about distracted driving. You know, we did add the increased fees for the tickets on the bipartisan basis last session, and now we're looking, as you know, at Representative Uglem and I are looking at some legislation to better enforce the texting ban. And what are you seeing in terms of trends with regard to, you know, being able to enforce this provision? I think that it's gone up over the years, but I think there's still a lot of people that are out there texting and driving, and we need to, you know, beef that up, I think, a little bit and allow, again, maybe a hands-free cell phone restriction in order to better enforce that. But what are you seeing from your officers and frontline people on the texting issue?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Colonel Langer to come down. He might be best equipped to answer this question. I can tell you that I know that his troopers and local law enforcement officers across the state have a very difficult time with the enforcement of texting and driving, just because if it's not happening when the traffic, you know, how do you witness that, and then how do you provide evidence in a court to ensure that the person that you are charging is actually guilty of the offense? But I'll let Colonel Langer address
that as
well.
Thank you. As the colonel takes his seat, I'm happy to accommodate member questions, and I want to share as much information as possible, but I also, we do have presentations to get through. I'm not trying to cut you off, Frank. I'm just kind of telling everybody that if we get too carried away with questions, we won't get our work done.
So, okay.
Colonel, please identify yourself for the record and answer the representative's question.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Langer. I serve as the chief of the State Patrol, and I think I heard the question. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, it is a difficult law to enforce. Troopers are frustrated like everybody else at the level of distraction that goes on while people are behind the wheel, whether it's texting and while driving or messing with their radio or eating or arguing with kids or doing everything else that we see behind the wheel. The concept of hands-free legislation would certainly aid law enforcement in enforcing the texting while driving law, because what we find is that troopers frequently see a violation, they stop and talk to the driver, and as you can imagine, many drivers are very forthright and say, yes, I was texting. Many drivers are less than forthright and say, no, I was not texting. I was looking for a phone number, which by law is not illegal, although it's just as distracting, arguably, as texting. So it's an interesting concept, and you know, we're looking for any way that we can to diminish the amount of distraction that goes on while people are driving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi, did you have another question?
Okay, so yes, I do. And you can maybe provide this with us after. But for the commissioner, I didn't see the word pedestrian on there. And I was just wondering, I know you are involved in Towards Zero Death, which I like to think of as Vision Zero. But what are pedestrian fatalities last year went up to 60 now? Is it 60 or 90? I think it's 60. And it was 17 the previous year. I call that skyrocketing. What role does your department play in helping us have zero pedestrian fatalities? I mean, let me just say this. How will your office work to get those numbers back down? What role do you play in doing that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, I guess my best answer to that would be that our state troopers will be out enforcing traffic laws. Some of these deaths happen on local streets, and so our troopers are not patrolling local streets, but they certainly would assist local agencies when the incidents occur. I think Donna Berger, our Office of Traffic Safety Director, could speak more to, and we could provide more information at a later date, as to really the cause, because it's sometimes people trying to outrun a vehicle, get across an intersection. Sometimes it's distracted walking. Sometimes it's distracted driving that strikes a pedestrian. And so we collect statistics, we watch national trends, and we do enforcement where we are allowed to enforce laws, traffic laws.
Thank you. Representative Drozdowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I'm curious, or I didn't catch the gentleman's name.
Colonel Langer.
Colonel, thank you. Representative Hornstein, of course, brought up texting and driving, which gets everybody's neurons working here. Yeah. One of the things I've seen, Colonel, is, and I've wondered why, if we're getting down to the point where your interaction with your cell phone is distracted driving, how about when you've got the little old man or little old lady driving the car with Fluffy on her lap? How distracting is that? And obviously everybody loves Fluffy, so this particular body hasn't had the courage to bring forward a prohibition against Fluffy, but how much danger does Fluffy provide?
Colonel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Viskowski, you know, I think all of us were sort of smiling when you said that because we all see a lot of ridiculous behavior by people that are driving down the road or down the freeway at 70 miles an hour. Having a dog on the lap, of course, is one of those things that we would say officially is distracting you from the task at hand, which is driving. Although there's no law that specifically prohibits that, it goes in the category of all kinds of things that common sense would say you should not do while you're driving.
So, Mr. Chair?
A follow-up, Representative Dreskov.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Colonel, can someone get a ticket for having Fluffy on their lap while they're going 65 miles an hour?
Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dreskov, I think it could be argued to fall under the duty to drive with due care, which is a pretty widely interpreted catch-all for things that basically says you ought to pay attention and drive at a reasonable speed and be careful behind the wheel, but nothing specifically prohibits anything related to animals on one's lap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sounds like the answer is no. And if one more quick question, Mr. Chair?
Very quick, Representative Dreskov.
Well, we really love Fluffy, Mr. Chair. Colonel, are you aware of any times that people have been arrested for hauling Fluffy on their lap at 65 miles an hour or 55 or any other speed?
Colonel, I assume he means more than just Fluffy. It could be Fido or, you know. Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Viskowski, nothing comes to mind.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck has a quick question.
Right. It is a quick question, Mr. Chair. Ms. Doman, is this the department that handles local street speed limits? And is that in your department or is that elsewhere within MnDOT?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, are you talking about establishing speed limits or are you talking about enforcing speed limits?
Setting speed limits, Mr. Chair and Ms. Doman.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is not within our jurisdiction or within our authority.
Thank you. Representative Rosenthal has a short question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Colonel. Sort of getting back to Representative Hornstein's question and hands-free driving, I just came back from New York. Or my sister called me, I instinctively answered the phone, was immediately pulled over, and the officer was very, very serious about the danger of driving while using a cell phone. I want to know, how does our state compare to other states? How many states have a ban on cell phone use?
Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, I don't have the statistics off the top of my head. There are some states that have certainly banned or created hands-free legislation. There's also some cities that have done that, but it's not necessarily, certainly not a novel idea.
Thank you. I believe we are now prepared to get back to your presentation, Commissioner, or Deputy Commissioner.
I do remember. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were just about to talk about the Office of Traffic Safety and their annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund is $457,000. That is a required state match which allows the Office of Traffic Safety to secure federal funds, grants, and other types of one-time money, which they receive. Driver and Vehicle Services, right? This is the division that touches almost every Minnesotan at one time or another, either through the issuance of a driver's license or hope to get a driver's license, being the parent of somebody getting a driver's license, or identification card, or anything dealing with the titling or registering of motor vehicles. Their units are title and registration. I did ask for a few statistics just to give you an understanding. They're not in the PowerPoint. But the number of registered vehicles in Minnesota today is over 5 million. The number of vehicle transactions that were done by Driver and Vehicle Services last year, 2016, was almost 1.5 million. The number of driver's licenses or identification cards that were issued in 2016 was about 1.7 million. So they do a lot with 538 employees who work in 95 locations throughout the state. In addition, they partner with 175 business partners, frequently referred to as deputy registered or driver's license agents. Their funding, they receive an annual appropriation of approximately $58 million through the Special Revenue Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. They collect more than $1.4 billion in revenue through fees and taxes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Within this subject, it comes to mind that I've heard some comments about title registrations coming back kind of slow. Things that people being received tickets in the mail because their title hasn't been changed, that they don't have the title. They've applied for it, but it just hasn't come. In my own district, I had a young lady in the North Dakota side arrested because it was over 3 months that she had, her dad had purchased the car. And she was actually arrested because the title showed that she had stolen it from a dealership. But when, in fact, the dealership had applied and all the paperwork had gone through. And I'm just wondering what's happening with titling and why is it taking so long for that action to happen?
Deputy Commissioner.
I will attempt to answer that, Mr. Chair and Representative. And if we need further clarification, we can ask Don Olson, the director, to come and answer it. But the simple answer is, yes, it takes too long, quite frankly, to get a title in Minnesota right now. Part of this is the staffing issues, and another large part of it is that Driver and Vehicle Services is currently in the process of the development and the rollout of the new MNLARS system. That's the Minnesota License and Registration System. That system, which is used for anything related to drivers or vehicles or identification. And that process is happening. Once we fully migrate onto that MNLARS system, and the vehicle services is going to migrate this spring, so that is going to happen fairly soon, that will speed up that process, and we should not see those turnaround times. But through the processing the change from this existing antiquated system to a new system, when you do that, there's some slowdowns. So it is recognized. They are working on it, and it will improve in the future.
A follow-up, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out that, we have put in, I believe, $1.3 million back in 2013 for additional staff already, and there was salary increases. I guess my constituency was just very frustrated to the point the dealership said it's happened so many times. She's actually thinking about moving across the river because she said when she sells a car, people are pretty upset, and this father was extremely upset. Bad experience for a young lady, but probably a lesson, too, about making sure your title is changed. But in this case, she had no control over it. So I'm hoping that we can make sure that, in my world, North Dakotans get it within weeks. So there's a lot of comparison. How come they get it so fast and we aren't? And I realize we're more people in Minnesota, too. But anyway, hope we can work on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are working on that. And I would also urge, obviously, if constituents come to you with issues, feel free to notify either the commissioner, myself, or directly the director of vehicles, driver vehicle services, Don Olson, because sometimes in situations there is something that can be done.
Along those lines, I have a question. It seems like there is apparently a significant backlog of title applications. As you transition into the new system, how do you handle that backlog?
May I call the
Please
Don
do.
Olson?
All
right.
Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Don Olson, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And Mr. Chair, to answer your question, how are we handling the backlog as we move into the new system? Right now, we're about 50 days behind. That is our longest backlog. We have different title types that we issue. Some of those happen very quickly. Some of those just take longer. And so about 50 days is the longest time we have. Right now, we have dropped that down since early November from 90 days down to 50 days. So our push right now is we have staff working overtime. We brought in some temporary staff to work at getting that backlog down. So when we turn the new system on, we're going to have a period of transition where we have to get old work in and start working in the new system. And we want to get to that to within 2 to 3 weeks to minimize that as much as possible.
So will you enter those backlog applications into the new system at that point, or will you ramp down the old system?
Mr. Chair, that's a very interesting question, because what we have to do is track the paperwork to where the financial information is at. And when the financial information comes in, that comes in at the deputy office. They take that money in. They make that transaction whole. Then the paperwork comes to us. So for a period of time, even though the new system's up, we're going to have to continue to put work that's there, the backlog work, into the old system and then convert it over to the new.
Thank you. Representative Lucero has a question.
It's more of a comment to Representative Keel's point. I've experienced several title transfers in last year, and there's a little-known program. It's called Expediting Your Title. And if you pay an extra $20, you can get your title in typically about 2 days. And most people don't know about that, and it's frustrating that I even have to do that, but whenever I'm advising constituents or anybody that I'm dealing with regarding title transfers, just unfortunately have to cut through the government bureaucracy and pay an extra $20 to get it in 2 days, as one would expect it to be.
We won't take any comments. So, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somewhat related on this new MnLAR system, Commissioner, that will extend to driver's licenses also?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it will.
Okay, kind of two quick questions off of that come to mind.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the new driver's licenses, I know, and you probably don't like when we compare state to state. I appreciate that fact, but that's how we understand things. Because other states produce a driver's license at the point source, correct? Are we going to be doing that, or are we not going to be doing that?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and representatives, Minnesota has always been a central issue state, which means we take the documentation in, and the documentation is reviewed at the central office. So all of our driver's licenses have always been issued from a central office. It's true that some states will issue right on the spot. They'll go through the application process and can issue right away. However, Minnesota has always taken a strong stand against fraud prevention, wanting to have a second set of eyes look at that documentation. So at this point, I do not believe that we would go any other direction but what we are now.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. We're going to have impending legislation here on Real ID here very soon. Is the MnLAR system equipped to handle whatever changes we may have should Real ID legislation move forward and we have effectively different types of driver's licenses?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we will.
Thank you. I believe we're ready to get back to the presentation once again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Office of Pipeline Safety ensures that pipeline companies are operating in a safe manner by abiding by all pipeline regulations. You might be familiar with the Call Before You Dig education that they do. They work with pipeline companies to ensure that those companies understand the regulations, understand their obligations. They also enforce, provide enforcement and inspection. They receive an annual appropriation of $3.13 million from the special revenue and federal funds. I think on the slide it also indicates $1.35 million is a direct appropriation derived from inspection fees.
I have a question about the pipeline and railroad safety account. Would either of you be able to answer that, or do you need to call a friend? I haven't asked the question yet, of course, so you probably don't know.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I would just say we may need a lifeline. But.
So this, and I'm not real familiar with this account myself, but I did receive this question. So what are your plans for that account? Apparently it was on the railroads and pipeline people contribute to that account. Is that correct? And what are your plans for utilizing those funds?
Mr. Chair and members, we are going to continue. This, the legislature directed the Department of Public Safety to give like rail safety 101 training to the local first responders along the rail lines specifically, and so we have done that familiarization training, or we are continually doing that familiarization training, and so we are using funds to reimburse locals to attend that training. There's currently a roughly $6 million in that account, that and that assessment on the railroads is set to sunset at the end of June of this year.
So, Commissioner, with $6 million in the account and the potential sunset, would you support the sunset of the account at this time?
I can tell you, Mr. Chair, that we are having conversation about that at the present time.
All right. We'll discuss this further down the road, I take it. Anything else? Any other questions from members? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation today. We look forward to working with you throughout the session.
Likewise, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Next, we'll bring Colonel Langer back, I believe. We've had an issue with truck weights, especially in regard to milk trucks. Representative Garzkowski has been pursuing this pretty vigorously, and I don't know exactly how we intend to proceed. Do you want to make a presentation first, Colonel?
Mr. Chair, it'd be up to you. I could present kind of an overview of what we do with commercial vehicle enforcement, or I could go right into the question.
We've got some time. Let's go ahead with an overview, Colonel.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll attempt to give a brief overview of what the State Patrol does related to size and weight and other enforcement of commercial motor vehicles. On the agenda, it sells an overview of our milk truck program. We don't have a specific milk truck program. They would be deemed commercial vehicles in most cases and would fall under what we do in terms of commercial vehicle enforcement. Commercial motor vehicle enforcement is a division within the State Patrol. It's headed by a captain. And there are about 100 people, roughly, that work under that division, both sworn and non-sworn members, that go out and they're charged with enforcing Minnesota and federal laws related to commercial motor vehicle, whether it's the driver issues, the equipment issues, size, weight enforcement, and a lot of education to go with that as well. We've received $8.2 million, roughly, in state trunk highway funds each year and about another $4 million in federal grant funds each year that are specifically used for commercial vehicle enforcement. Within the Commercial Vehicle Enforcement Division, and I suspect this is one of the questions that has come up, we do what is called civil weight enforcement. And so that has been an issue that has been brought forward, I believe, through Representative Duszkowski's constituency up through our division. And so with the civil weight enforcement, what the State Patrol does is we follow state statutes that allow for our employees to go into facilities and see the receipts of people that are hauling loads, you know, in the case of milk, from a farm to that first point of entry to market. And they look at those bills or the receipts for the weight of the product coming in, and we follow the statute and we follow our policies, and essentially we go in from time to time and we look at the previous up to 14 days worth of receipts, and we search for violations of Minnesota law related to weight, commercial motor vehicle weight. The statute provides a number of guiding principles that we follow. We do not touch anything unless it's 3,000 pounds or more overweight. There's a 10% give or take tolerance for farm vehicles to include milk. Farm vehicles with three axles or less are exempt from weight law. And we're dealing with gross weight rating, gross vehicle weight only, not the registration when we're talking about civil weight enforcement. Of course, special permits are exempt from this process, and the ultimate result is those people that are hauling milk or any other product to market and are doing so overweight can end up either in conciliation court or in district court, depending on the dollar amount involved with the overweight charges that are actually prescribed by statute. The overweight is prescribed in the statute itself. Maximum penalty is $10,000. The first two violations for farm vehicles cannot exceed $150 per violation. Just some facts and figures related to civil weight enforcement, if that is indeed the focus of the questioning. We have about 15 people that worked on that project or that particular aspect of our work last year during calendar year 2016. They opened about 482 individual cases that involved 1,073 loads. Mm-hmm. The total amount of overweight violations that they discovered in the course of their work was 9.5 million pounds of overweight that had already gone down our roads and then had been discovered by this project. That resulted in about $392,000 in fine money. One of the questions that we get relatively often is, where does that fine money go? The simple answer to that question is not back into our State Patrol appropriation. It's dealt with as other fine money is dealt with. It doesn't have any benefit to our appropriation within our budget. Interesting to note, of the 482 cases of civil weight dealing specifically with milk or dairy products, we only had 18 of those 482 that were dairy, accounted for just under 4% of all the work that we did in this arena last year. One of the questions we also get is, why do we do weight enforcement? And the answer to that question is quite simple. It's two reasons. Number one is it's unsafe for equipment to be hauling product more than it is designed to carry. And number two, very important as taxpayers, it protects the infrastructure, meaning our roads that are built, from being destroyed earlier than necessary. Another question we get is, what role does MnDOT have? And some questions that have come up related to the FAST Act federally deal specifically with milk and allowing that product to be hauled in excess of the 80,000-pound weight limit. But I would ask any questions about the FAST Act and that particular piece to go to our colleagues at MnDOT, because they have jurisdiction over that piece. We have jurisdiction, obviously, over the enforcement that results from that legislation. We do a lot of other stuff related to commercial motor vehicle enforcement that was intended to give a really brief overview of how that work gets done, with a specific emphasis on what I suspect might be some questions that Representative Duszkowski or others might have specific to milk as a commodity.
Thank you, Colonel. Representative Duszkowski, you didn't raise your hand, but I'm assuming you have a question.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Colonel. I think you outlined it pretty well. One of the things, in southeast Minnesota, we're part of the Dairy Belt. The Dairy Belt members in Minnesota goes from southeast to northwest through the state. And so people up in Representative Keel's area and Representative Howe's area and others are are in that dairy belt, and we certainly have a lot of cows down in southeast Minnesota. We've also got a topography that compounds the situation because trucks cannot, we cannot simply provide bigger trucks in order to get some of the additional weights that can be achieved legally. So that's those really all kind of compound the situation. That, of course, is brought forward by the topography. Trucks cannot turn around and maneuver if they're too big on hills and sharp curves and other entries into dairy facilities, milk into farm facilities. But the folks that are driving down by us have said that, Colonel, they've noticed this really picked up. Prior to a year ago, they really didn't have a problem, but it seems that there's been a flurry of activity in the last year really concentrated on them. So what changed?
Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Juskowski, I don't have historical data in front of me showing the last 3, 4, 5 years of data, but what I do know is in 2016, only 18 of 482 cases involved dairy products. 173 actually involved field crops. So I don't know that anything changed specifically, but something obviously has put this on the radar for one or more of your constituents.
Representative Juskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Colonel. And, you know, I mean, some of my constituents are getting fines of $5,000 and $10,000 for small family-owned businesses where they've got a couple of trucks, and that's really a concern for our people. So I appreciate you being here to answer questions and give some feedback today to us. I don't have any – I mean, these numbers are helpful, but I'll be bringing some legislation forward, hopefully working with you and other people from your department and MnDOT, and members here so that we can find a way to make it work for these business owners, because they are just getting crushed by these fines. I do have another question, Colonel. How many other states have laws that allow you to go into, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, so it might not be fair, that do you know of any other states that allow you to go into the facilities and retroactively and without a subpoena pull up weight records from a private facility for up to 2 weeks back? Is that what, expound on that, if you will, and the authority you have there.
Colonel Langer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Juskowski, I like to be able to answer any question that gets thrown at me. I don't have that off the top of my head. I'd be happy to follow up with you specifically on what other states have similar legislation. And it's important to note that as a department, what we're doing is we're following state statute that allows for us to do what we feel is an important part of our entire commercial vehicle enforcement plan each year, to do the best job we can to make sure that people are following laws and that the drivers are obeying what they need to be obeying to be safe, that the equipment is held up to standard, and that the weight limits are not exceeding what our roads can handle. But I will be happy to follow up with you specifically on where we sit in context with other states.
So, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Barr has a question.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And Colonel, could you restate the amount in fees that you collect? And then also you mentioned that it doesn't go to your budget, and tell us where it does go.
Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, good question. So last year we had $392,472 in penalties that were ultimately assessed. And it's, again, statute dictates how those fines are assessed and how we handle those cases, whether it's in conciliation court or whether it's in district court with the Attorney General's office representing us in those cases. But sometimes people think that people have the misconception that when someone gets fined $1,000, that somehow comes back into the State Patrol's appropriation. And I think as members of this committee, you realize that our appropriation is set, and it's irregardless of the fine money that might be collected by this project or any other enforcement action of the State Patrol. So we don't benefit specifically from any of the fine money generated here. Obviously, the fine money does trickle back into the state and other coffers, but it doesn't impact our appropriation specifically.
No follow-up. A follow-up from Senator Barr?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So you don't know where those funds go. I'm just trying to get a sense of where those monies go when they're collected.
Maybe that's a question for someone else. I'm not sure.
We'll know shortly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a complicated explanation at best. I don't know that I feel fully prepared to answer exactly how that money gets distributed from the point of entry into the criminal justice system by conciliation court or district court.
I'm going to see if our brilliant staff can elucidate on this issue.
Mr. Chair and members, as the Colonel notes, it is a complicated set of formulas. There are multiple allocations, and there's a degree of variation depending on location, circumstances, whether prosecution occurs. One of the scenarios involving that's more specific to motor vehicle weight, in which the state patrol is involved, as well as some cases where another employee of the state, like MnDOT, might be involved. The allocation under that scenario would be fine revenue going 3/8 to the general fund and 5/8 to the highway user tax distribution fund. But I just would want to note that I haven't looked into that and gotten my head wrapped around all the formulas involved. So I just kind of want to put an asterisk on that distribution.
Thank you. You've revealed some of the complexity. Representative Nelson.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we wanted to increase money in the highway user distribution fund, we could have the State Patrol go out and fine a lot of, or catch a lot of people and fine them. It would raise revenue for more roads and bridges. I'm just kidding. I may say that, but
I was trying to figure out how we could apply that to Democrats only, myself. But since you were volunteering, Representative Keel has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm listening to the conversation of agricultural commodities and the fines, and I am a farmer. So I watch all the conversations here about them in my local area. Obviously, my county highway guy is constantly reminding me about the truck weights, and I do know that there's a formula for different types of trucks and how you load the axles so that it spreads the weight out and is better for the roads. My point being is, rather than fining everybody for overweight, I'm sure we can find people that are deliberately doing it consistently. But most of my farmers are just trying to get their work done. And they're challenged with trying to get a crop in, whatever it is, whether it's milk or corn or soybeans or whatever, or even animals. So what I think we should be doing is working together as a team of farmers and MnDOT, because this affects our county roads and our township roads also. And I know that the farmers don't want to wreck the roads because they got to drive on them. And let me tell you, folks, driving a big truck on a rough road because it's been damaged is a nightmare. It's very challenging. And when you're trying to get things in commodities where they need to go, it's you're trying to move, not too fast. But anyway, my point is that I think if we can, we should be working on something that works for everybody rather than, I don't know, how would you say it, good cop, bad cop type of thing, because there's other concerns. We want to make sure those trucks are have good tires and all of those things, and I know farmers make sure that trucks work. I've watched our trucks be stopped because a taillight is out. Very frustrating because it was working 5 minutes ago, and our law enforcement guys are pretty good about it. In fact, quite often you'll find them driving a beat truck on their off hours. So they do get the problems involved in hauling commodities. But I guess I would encourage members to see if we can't work out something that is just more beneficial for everyone, making sure the roads are good and the trucks balance. And I hear often complaints about large trucks, but in fact we have to think about the fact that a larger truck hauls once over a road, or else you've got a smaller truck hauling two loads. So there's that concept of going over the road more than you need to. And for farmers, it's getting harder to find people that can actually haul. So thus you see the bigger trucks, which helps us to get those crops in. So it's something to think about. I guess that's what I'm saying. Can we work together and rather than have these entities all be fighting? Because we all need the same thing.
Colonel Langer, Representative Keels asked you to think. Do you have any? Have you thought of anything?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, I hadn't planned on thinking the rest of the day, but I think you bring up a number of good points, and you know, I'll point out too that many of our troopers live in rural America. They live on family farms. They grew up on farms. My wife's family is a dairy farmer. They're dairy farmers, so we're sympathetic to a lot of these issues. And we certainly understand the role of agriculture and the chaos that ensues when the rain is coming and you've got a certain amount of time to get the job done. And mm-hmm. We're sympathetic to those issues, but we, as our job, our mission is, of course, to keep an eye toward safety on our roads, which means behavior and equipment issues and enforcing the law. So I agree with you, it's complicated, and my staff, myself, we're more than happy to meet and visit, whether it's with you or Representative Zukowski or any other members here, to look for ways that we can do this the most effectively. I would like to enforce these laws less and have higher compliance. Our goal is not enforcement, it's compliance. And I think we've got a good track record of making that the priority, along with a lot of education, because these issues can be complex and it requires education so people understand how to comply with the law.
Representative Miller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is actually for MnDOT, but I have a brief comment. So if someone from MnDOT wants to come down in regard to the Federal FAST Act, and they can answer to that. But as they're coming down, Mr. Chair, to Colonel, and with what Representative Keel said, I drive a sugar beet truck. Mm-hmm. And so I know what she's talking about when they have the ability to pull our tickets and go back into it and say, well, you violated here, 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 and here. And if you've ever driven a sugar beet truck, it's a pretty narrow margin. I'm amazed that when we're in the field how accurately they can drop the beets on us. But maybe one of the points of discussion in the future would be, rather than going back and saying violation, 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 and here's what the ticket price is on each of those, that we have more of you can see where the bad operators are. I guess maybe I don't like them going in and looking at the tickets and getting on the yard and looking at that sort of stuff. But even if you do that, it seems to be that there needs to be more of an issue of we have a pattern here and maybe there's a fine related to that. But what happens is in the sugar beet land, in a 12-hour shift, we're a small operation. We'll have five trucks, and that 12 hours will each go 12, 14 rounds. Mm-hmm. And so multiply that by the number of trucks, and you have beets that come in at different size, mud, all the stuff that I know you understand. But you can have a problem really fast before you even realize it, and you rectify the problem. But if someone comes in and looks, they say, well, you have these eight violations, and here's whatever the fine. You said $100 a piece or whatever it is. So just something to consider in the future. So the question, Mr. Chair, if I could, I do have a question now with MnDOT on the FAST Act.
I thought you were going to ask the Colonel to do some more thinking.
Yeah.
A question for MnDOT from Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reading here that the Federal FAST Act in 2016 gave an exception for milk trucks to be able to do higher weights, and that there are states that are exercising this, but Minnesota is not exercising that. So the first question I have, is that true or not true?
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead and answer the representative's question.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Laura Rhodes, and I'm a staff attorney in MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. Representative Miller, with respect to your question, what the FAST Act did is there's a portion of the United States Code that sets the kind of legal vehicle weight limit at 80,000 pounds. And there's kind of a broad exception that vehicles that are carrying a load that is non-divisible cannot be made smaller, and that has been issued a special permit can exceed that weight limit. And previously, milk, you know, had not been considered a non-divisible load. And so what the FAST Act specifically did was to create or add language to make fluid milk product a non-divisible load. And so that essentially gives states the discretion to issue permits for fluid milk products at higher than that 80,000-pound limit. And with respect to your second question, we have been working, so part of our office has a special permits section, and we have been working with, you know, neighboring states to see kind of what everybody else is doing. And I think the language in the FAST Act certainly left people with, you know, lots of questions, because it's not a requirement, it's a discretionary, you know, measure that went into place. And so I think we are, you know, still kind of struggling to figure out how that works. Currently in state law, there is a agricultural products permit, and that is for 6- and 7-axle vehicle combinations and can haul, you know, above that 80,000-pound limit. And so, it, you know, there's already a provision in place, you know, that milk haulers can take advantage of.
Follow up, Representative Miller?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. I thought I followed you, and then maybe I missed it. So you're saying there is already permitting capabilities to exceed? Because I know, again, I'm going back to my experience as a sugar beet driver. In harvest season, we can permit to exceed a load weight. So you're saying there's those tools already in place in Minnesota? Is that what you're saying? They can permit to get a weight waivers, I guess, to a greater weight? Is that what you're saying? Did I understand that properly?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a state statute that exists for agricultural products, and so milk would be considered an agricultural product, and so that is for vehicles with 6 or more axles, and they can haul 90,000 pounds kind of throughout the year. Vehicles with 7 or more axles can haul 97,000 pounds, I believe. And so that is something that is already in state law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you. So it's based on the axles then, correct? Is that what we talked about with that then? Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'm terrible. What's your name again?
Ms. Rhodes.
Ms. Rhodes, thank you. So in the case of Representative Droskowski's case where they're kind of in a bind where they have to have the smaller vehicles, I'm assuming the engineering is not necessarily possible. It doesn't blend well with that rule. Would that be a fair statement to make?
Ms. Rhodes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. And so what happens, and I believe Representative Keel sort of mentioned that there is a formula where you're looking at the length of the vehicle, the number of axles, and how the weight is spread out, you know, kind of accordingly. And so in previous meetings that we've had this fall with Representative Droskowski and members of the milk hauling industry, that is sort of the problem that they face, that the size of the vehicle, they don't have enough length to spread out the axles to kind of bridge that weight. Right.
One more final quick question.
Ms. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rhodes, right?
Yes, like things you drive on.
That's amazing. I should have picked up on that one and I missed it. A little slow. It's a Thursday. So if we were to, you say, my understanding is you're talking about this FAST Act change, this update, where milk is now considered not whatever the term was that you said. You can't break it down into pieces. Is that decision a department decision on whether to act on the FAST Act, or is that a legislative process? What under the FAST Act, what is required if we were to want to move forward with something like that?
Ms. Rhodes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I don't know exactly. I think it would require likely a legislative change. You know, right now, kind of as I mentioned, there's that, you know, legal weight limit that you cannot go beyond unless you're operating under a special permit. And the special permits that exist in state statute are kind of largely commodity specific. And so, you know, and certain permits, you know, get into those details of, you know, vehicle configuration, how many axles. And so I think, you know, right now there is nothing in state law to allow us to permit one of those shorter milk hauling trucks at higher levels, higher weight limits.
Thank you. Representative Barr.
Just a couple of comments and then a question for the colonel, so I'll give you a heads up so you can warm up over there. I am not a farmer, and I am not a beet truck driver, but I am a small business owner, so I can appreciate the comments from Representative Keel and Representative Miller about the strain something like this can place on farmers and small business owners is what they are. So my question goes back to my earlier question about the fees that are assessed, and I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of what's the cost to actually collect on those assessed fees? Like, what's the cost either in time or prosecution or whatever? You mentioned, I think, that it depends on how you go about prosecuting that. Could you talk a little more about that?
Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, you're exactly right. There is a cost for us to do this work, number one, and then there's a cost to bring it to trial, so to speak, and be successful with prosecution or successful in conciliation court, and the Attorney General's office helps us as well. I don't have the data with me right now that would say how much that is, but we do obviously have staff that gets involved, and it costs more for someone that takes a case to trial than it does for someone who pleads guilty, but it's common sense, and I'm sure you understand that. I want to also point out that the statute, I can't speak to the underlying rationale, but there are some advantages for farmers when it comes to the fines, particularly the first two instances, but I think speaks to some of the concern that has been brought up by you and other members.
A follow-up, Representative Barr.
Yes, just one final comment. I would reiterate with Representative Keel said that if we could find a way to be more in partnership and less punitive, that would be, I think, a win-win. Thank you.
Representative Nelson has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess it's more of a comment. In my long time in the legislature, I originally served on this committee with Bernie Leader as chair, and this truck weight discussion and farm exemptions have been, I think, every term or every session we have these discussions. But adding more axles and everything else doesn't diminish the amount of weight that's going on our bridges, and many of those bridges in our rural areas are deficient bridges. So we're just putting more weight on them. We're talking about costs here. We're talking about cost to the business owner and the farmer, but we're also talking about cost to our roads that we end up having to pay for out of our budget here and repair, and we never have enough money to do that, which is why I believe when they said that part of the money for the fines goes to the Highway User Distribution Fund, it's to help pay for the damage that was done to those roads. So as we talk about this, yes, it's tough on the business owners, and we want to make sure we help them to learn to not load their trucks enough or overload their trucks, because we end up all paying for that cost. But we need to, we have to be fair here, because it's not just those business owners that they're constantly violating the law. We can't let them off. It's no different than one of my constituents who's late for work and speeding to say, well, I should get out of this ticket because I'm speeding because I got to get to work. It's kind of what we're saying here in a little bit grander scale. So we have to be cautious as we move forward that we are talking about trying to preserve our roads, and that's why these fines are put in, and that's why these things are there, is to keep our roads safe and keep our roads in condition that we can all drive on them.
Thank you, Representative, for those comments. It is a double-edged sword, as you reveal. I would add that the roads only get fixed, a percentage of them only get fixed when the bonding bill gets to the governor's desk. I have another question from Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. In a similar vein of Representative Nelson, when we have this discussion, we lose sight that it's also a business issue and an economic issue to, have our roads maintained. And I've had the pleasure, over the years of traveling around the state and talking to farmers. And we had a great meeting in Wilmer, Representative Baker, last year, the year before, the Lieutenant Governor, I think, convened it. And I just have a very clear memory of that, where there was a farmer that talked about, the roads being so rough that, his eggs were getting you know, they're not, you know, cracked, and he loses money and loses product because of the condition of our roads. So, you know, you're right, Mr. Chairman. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, and I think in this discussion we can't lose sight of the fact that, you know, we can talk about truck weights, but without a parallel conversation about investing in our infrastructure, and particularly the maintenance part, which I'm sure this will come up in committee eventually. You know, MnDOT talks about being way behind in the maintenance budget. And, you know, without maintaining our roads, without expanding our roads, you know, this, you know, this conversation will continue to go on and on, as Representative Nelson said. So we're going to talk about truck weights. Then we absolutely have to talk about, you know, what's the plan to, you know, have the revenue that we need to, you know, maintain and expand our system. Because farmers are losing money because of, they can't get their products to market because of the condition of roads.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Howe, do you have a question or a comment?
No, Mr. Chair, I thank you, but I'd kind of like to clarify something. I think the reason that the federal government in the FAST Act identified milk as a non-divisible product is because whatever doesn't go on that truck, and if you start putting it on that truck and you get to a certain weight and you stop, the rest of the milk in that bulk tank is going on the ground, yeah, because you can't split the load. So when it comes to milk, we have to identify that that is a different commodity than your normal agricultural commodity that you could stop putting the corn on and put the corn on another truck. When you stop putting, drawing that milk out of that bulk tank, the rest of that milk goes on the ground. So I think that's what the federal government figured out on the FAST Act, and I believe that's what we need to take action. And I firmly believe, I guess maybe the Department of Public Safety doesn't have rulemaking authority that they could make that rule. But if that's the case, then, well, we should do it legislatively. But that, you know, if you didn't understand that milk is, that's the way that works, we need to fix that. So that's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a good discussion. And thank you for coming, Ms. Rhodes. I didn't know you were in the audience. And I did catch on to the roads part before Representative Miller did.
That seniority thing, Representative Drazkowski.
Yeah, the gray hair still finds it. Ms. Rhodes, you know, the states around us have, I think they've already made adjustments to the FAST Act. I've got a chart here. Minnesota's at 88,000 pounds for milk, Wisconsin, 98,000, Iowa, 90,000, North Dakota, 105,000, South Dakota, 129,000. And so I was with the understanding your department had the ability to make adjustments according to the FAST Act, that it didn't take legislative authority, but maybe we need to research that some more as we go through the bill writing and so forth. But when we had the meeting down in Zimbrota, we were there a few weeks before the election, and your folks said, well, we're working on some language. We want to make some adjustments, and we want to use the FAST Act in order to accommodate the industry. And then we heard of, you know, a month or so later after the election that that didn't seem to be the case anymore. And so I'm curious what happened in the department. Why did things change?
Ms. Rhodes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, when we met in Zimbrota, we did indicate that we were hoping to pursue some legislation that primarily would be to kind of clarify what the FAST Act intended. So the agricultural product permit that I mentioned, one of the restrictions placed on vehicles operating under that permit is that they may not operate on the interstate. And so, you know, it was our understanding with that change in the FAST Act that for vehicles hauling fluid milk product, that the federal government, you know, was saying, okay, you can operate it at weights higher than 80,000 pounds on the interstate. And so that was, and still is, going to be our legislative proposal, is to create some kind of clarity for both permitting and enforcement that those vehicles hauling fluid milk under that product can operate on the interstate.
Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. I understood at the time and recollect actually a broader discussion about reviewing and revising the law, and actually it seemed to me at that point the department was ready to take the lead. Actually, we were anticipating a draft from the department, and that never came, and so it was kind of disappointing, that whole change of events, which seemed to happen sometime after the election. So I don't know exactly what happened there, but members, we do have a problem here with milk, certainly in southeast Minnesota. These farmers are going to have to pay more and more for milk hauling if we don't make some changes here, and some of these small businesses are going to have a very difficult time operating. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for your discussion on this issue. I'll be bringing forward 1 to 3 bills on this particular topic of varying scopes. I think one of them, I think we look at all ag commodities, because logs and Ms. Rhodes, maybe you remember, logs and a variety of other materials already have higher limits. They're carved out into law, and so there might be merit in raising the others at the same time so that we can accomplish things in a way that makes sense. So unless Ms. Rhodes or does anybody else have questions, maybe, but thank you, Mr. Chair. I almost elevated you to speaker, Mr. Chair.
I'm not ready. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I think this question might be for you. Mr. Chair.
Really?
We're having I'm just following the lead here. You know, I didn't want to be left out on the fun. So So the question is, Representative Nelson had mentioned earlier that our railroads were, I think the word he used were deficient. And I'm wondering if this committee at some point will be getting any kind of report on the state of our roads.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
We will delve into that quite a bit, and we're not done with truck rate weights either. I do have a few things I would like to clarify with the testifiers. First, I've been told that there are locations in Minnesota where we have scales that are actually built into the pavement of our roads. Is this correct, and how common are they? I don't know which one of you wants to answer that. Ms. Rhodes,
sure.
Looks like.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are fixed way facilities around the state. I believe that there are 6. It is sort of a joint effort between MnDOT and the State Patrol. Technically, MnDOT owns and maintains those buildings, but it is the State Patrol that staffs them.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm not talking about where you pull off the road and get weighed on a scale that's obvious to you. I'm talking about some kind of new technology that's actually embedded in the pavement that weighs you as you're traveling over that part of the road.
Okay, my apologies.
No problem.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there is something called a weigh in motion scale, and that is what is built into the pavement, as opposed to the fixed sites that I mentioned, and that is not the uses of those and locations is not my area of expertise. We can certainly get you that information if you have more specific questions. I believe that MnDOT's Office of Traffic Safety.
We'll find out. Do those facilities also measure speed?
The weigh in motion scales?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we're talking about two separate things. It's definitely a MnDOT issue, but on the traffic safety side, there are loops in the roads that MnDOT uses to survey speeds. But weigh in motion, to my knowledge, is a different. It's a similar technology that's embedded in the pavement, but I don't know that they're one and the same. I can speak to weigh in motion a little bit, how it's being used around the country as a benefit that many states have put weigh in motion prior to a scale. So in Minnesota, if you're westbound on 94 and the scale is open, any commercial vehicle that is over X number of pounds has to stop.
and the way in motion in some states, the way it's been deployed, is that it gives red flags and allows vehicles that are clearly underweight to just keep going, while incorporated with other technologies. So it greatly enhances the efficiency of those scale facilities and can help people hauling legal weights without any issues to just keep going and not stop. But we're using some of the technology now with portable scales and weigh in motion as a way to become more efficient and to do what I said, allow vehicles that are clearly fine to keep going and others to stop and be weighed versus stopping and weighing randomly every truck. It's a smarter way of doing weight enforcement.
So you mentioned both weigh in motion, portable scales. So are you talking about two separate technologies?
I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, Mr. Chair. I do have one person that could come down and answer a couple of questions specifically about what we're doing with portable scales and the way in motion.
We'll do that, and that person can come forward. But before we go there, I'm going to quick ask a couple of other questions. One, just a comment. Representative Nelson mentioned bridges. I believe that we do have bridge weight limits that are set for individual bridges, so no matter how many axles you have, if your truck is over the weight limit for that bridge, you are not supposed to go across that bridge. So we have a mechanism to protect those bridges. I realize it's tempting for a driver to keep right on rolling. Another question that I think, Colonel, you can probably answer. Up until 2 years ago or so, we had truck inspections, annual inspections for farm heavy trucks. And that changed. Those requirements are no longer in place. I believe it was a federal issue. I don't know if you want to answer that question, or perhaps our new expert at the table can answer that.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to someone that's been around a long time and has dealt with these issues for many, many years and is a subject matter expert.
Please identify yourself for the record. You don't have to give your age.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Jay Sletton. I am a commercial vehicle inspection supervisor with the State Patrol's commercial vehicle section.
So did you hear the questions? There were a number of them kind of floating around here.
There were a number of them.
So feel free to tell us what you know.
Maybe we'd like to kind of back up and start over a little bit.
I'd be fine. That's fine. We're here to learn.
Mr. Chair, representative, some of the questions that were asked were about do the weigh-in motion systems or the scales embedded in the pavement measure speed? The answer is yes. It's part of the process of identifying the length of the vehicle to determine if they are in compliance with weight limits. So that's a rather complex system for weighing those vehicles on the fly. The primary purpose of those scales that are embedded in the highways is for data collection, for the most part. It's just been in the recent years that we've been able to also adapt them for screening vehicles for weight enforcement. Traditionally, if we were set up for a roadside weighing operation, we would have to stop every single truck and weigh them using portable scales. Now, by using those weigh-in-motion systems, we can screen the vehicles and only stop the ones that are indicating that they are overweight. So it speeds up the process for our personnel as well as keeping the traffic moving, keeping the industry moving the goods. One of the additional questions was portable scales versus the weigh-in motions, and we do have some portable weigh-in motion systems now, too. We've only got two of them. They are not a high-speed weigh-in motion system. They are a low-speed sort of a thing. So, again, if we're doing a roadside weighing operation, we can set those up, and we can screen the trucks as they come in, and those that are not overweight can continue on down the road. It's another means of keeping traffic flowing and not holding up those people who are not violating the laws.
You're starting to make me nervous, you know that.
in a good way, I hope.
In a very good way, absolutely. Then the question of truck inspections, ag truck inspections.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I believe it was 2014 when MAP 21, the federal transportation bill was enacted. There were a number of items included in that bill provided relief or exemptions for farm vehicles, and part of that was that they are exempted from annual inspection requirements, daily inspections, and so forth. And to mirror that, we amended our statutes so those specific vehicles, what are referred to as covered farm vehicles, which has nothing to do with having a cover on them, but they're covered by the regulations, those vehicles are exempt from the annual inspections now. Owners of those vehicles, of course, are still welcome to have them inspected if they so desire. Many of them do. And they are also exempted from a number of the roadside inspection processes. If there's a probable cause issue that's added into the statute. Now, if we don't see a violation, we turn them loose. They're down the road. No inspection takes place.
At one time, there was a two-year sticker for farm vehicles. Was that... That, I think, was taken away some time ago.
Yes, it was.
Would it be within our jurisdiction to put that two-year inspection sticker back on the market, so to speak?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that because it's federally mandated that we would not want to go down that road.
Well, that's what I've heard in other cases. The feds have kind of tied our hands.
Yeah.
Colonel, perhaps you can enlighten us.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think safe to say we don't, of course, direct the direction of the legislature. You can act as you want, but what it would do is potentially put our federal funding in jeopardy, which I know comes up just about every session. If we act contrary to the wishes of the federal government, we could potentially lose out on the federal funding we get to do our business related to commercial vehicle enforcement.
We don't want to do that. That's all the questions I have. Oh, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Colonel Langer, I'm reading ahead here on the budget activity narrative. No, I'm sorry, it would be for the gentleman. Sorry, you don't have your name.
Jay Slatton.
Okay. But there's an interesting activity called traffic stops on passenger cars near commercial vehicles, 3,685 of them, and I can't imagine what that activity is. Could you explain that?
I can answer. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative, data suggests that oftentimes commercial vehicles aren't the problem in fatal and serious injury crashes. It's the vehicles that are around the commercial vehicles. So we've done some specific work. Our division has done some great work on trying to hone in on the issues that are creating fatal and serious injury crashes that happen to involve commercial motor vehicles. That's also been of high interest to the federal government to not just focus solely on the commercial vehicle because of their involvement, but focus on the causal factor, which is oftentimes the other cars that are operating inappropriately in and around the commercial vehicle going down the road.
The colonel. Then, if you, so do we have fatal accidents broken out somewhere in terms of the numbers associated, our total traffic fatalities associated with commercial vehicles?
Colonel,
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to. I can get you all of that. It would be in the Office of Traffic Safety's Crash Facts publication, and there's a whole section on commercial vehicle involved fatal crashes.
Thank you.
Colonel, could you describe the kind of driving behavior that is happening in these situations where motor passenger vehicles are causing accidents with large trucks?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's everything you can imagine. It's from cutting them off to not having good following distances, to not giving them a little bit of room because they're 80,000 pounds and they're big, and it takes them oftentimes longer to stop, and they aren't as maneuverable. So it doesn't take us long, and I know Sergeant Sletton hears from the commercial vehicle industry, the really reputable drivers and reputable companies, of which there are many. Their constant stress and frustration every day is not necessarily what they're doing. It's what cars are doing around them, and they just see absolutely everything you can imagine, and oftentimes get caught up in a fatal crash, many times through no fault of their own, other than being around someone who's behaving inappropriately, whether it's speeding or cutting off or doing all the things that we see on our highways.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it fair to say that where there's a lot of truck traffic and also, of course, automobile traffic, that it's safer on four-lane roads than on two-lane roads?
Colonel, I think I know where this is going, actually. Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a whole lot more engineering that goes into our interstate system than other roads, so the fatal and serious injury crash statistics definitely show that our interstate system is safer than many other route systems, but probably a combination of engineering and behavioral issues that are different for those different road types.
I thought sure I was going to hear about Highway 14.
23.
With that, I do not see any more questions. I want to thank you for a most informative presentation today. Thank you for answering our questions. Look forward to working with you in the future. Members, this meeting is adjourned.